Hello, my friends, and welcome to the next episode of the Just One More Thing podcast. Thank you for joining me. My name is Norji, and joining me today is my good friend Chavez, who in the last episode we recorded, or I recorded, or whatever you want to call it, you told a very harrowing tale about, I don't even call it a tale because it happened, about a very scary medical episode that, as we have come to find out, was a major stroke.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to go back a little bit and sort of recap what happened, but then also throw over to you and talk about how things have been going since we last spoke, since the event, because you've been in and out of the hospital and doing some therapy and stuff like that. So I'll let you talk about that. But for those of you who maybe weren't privy to the last episode, which it's a shame if you're not, because it was a really good episode, and a tough listen if you've ever been affected by this kind of thing or know someone who has been. But it was certainly tough to sit here and listen to it as it was happening in real time. But to go back a little bit, this was back in
March 3rd.
Man, that feels like forever ago, but it feels like this conversation happened 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So March 3rd, you woke up. You weren't feeling that great. You had a migraine, what you originally thought was a migraine.
Mm-hmm.
And you sat up in bed. And when you sat up, you felt, the sweats, the migraine, the not feeling well, like you were going to vomit. You basically felt what alluded to, or what seemed like migraine that was exacerbated by like feelings of nausea and that kind of thing. So it was kind of a normal day for you in that,
right?
You have migraines. It's not anything new for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're here by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going about your morning, and then all of a sudden, snap, you feel the sort of a difference, right? Because you're thinking it's a migraine, and then all of a sudden you're starting to feel like this feels like there's more going on.
Right.
And so as you're trying to sort of comprehend what's going on and maybe trying to rest a little bit, you're starting to discover that you're not able to hold anything down. You're vomiting a lot. You're sweating a lot. You're hot. You're cold. You're going back and forth. You're not sure what's going on. But you're also starting to discover as these symptoms are progressing that you are having difficulty doing things like walking. And so there was a point where you had to, you needed to go to the bathroom, but you couldn't do that. You couldn't simply stand up and walk to the bathroom like you had always been able to do. And so just getting to the bathroom was taxing because you didn't just walk to the bathroom. You were, whenever you did try to walk, it was almost like someone had blindfolded you and maybe put some vertigo,
mm-hmm,
something on you. And so it was, you were, you couldn't walk a straight line. You couldn't stand up straight without feeling like you were going to fall over. You were basically out of balance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you were able to get to the bathroom, perform your necessaries. I believe you said that you vomited again.
Mm-hmm.
In the bathroom.
No, not in the bathroom.
Okay.
Not in the bathroom.
But you came back and you had a bucket.
And then I threw up.
Yeah. And you sat down and you laid down and you said, I feel worse when I lay down than when I sit up.
Mm-hmm.
So you sat up and there were bouts of you were sitting up, you were laying down and going back and forth, trying to get some fluids in you, but you couldn't hold the fluids down.
Mm-hmm.
And so you started to realize that something was seriously wrong. And so I'm going to let you take it from here because I want people to hear it in your own words. That tell us about at what point during this ordeal you realized something was really wrong and sort of the process that you went through and that kind of stuff. And then we'll start to get into the more recent stuff.
Okay. Like you said, I woke up my head was hurting. I went to the bathroom to take the Tylenol, which was fine because I filled up the water glass. I walked to the bathroom, and I got the Tylenol. I took it, and on the way back is when I started to drift to the right. And because at that point, my right side was starting to give, was not working anymore.
Sure.
And that was weird. I just thought I was extremely tired, but I wasn't. I was losing the ability to get my right side to work.
Now at this point, and sorry to interrupt, were you having vision issues?
It's still dark. It's 5:29 in the morning. The only reason I know that it's that time is because I looked at the clock and it was like the only light in the room.
Sure.
So I don't know how bad my vision is at this point until it started to get light outside. Then I realized that my left eye's vision was going up and my right eye's vision was going down, kind of like a slot machine. I couldn't get it to stop. I couldn't focus. So I kept my eyes closed for the most part. And then I balanced myself on my arm because half laying down, half sitting up because I couldn't. Sitting up was hard and laying down was hard, or lying down or whatever. And I balanced there for a while until my arm didn't work anymore. My left arm didn't work anymore. I was just exhausted. So then I lay down, threw up a couple times. So then it's like, okay, this is serious. This isn't just a migraine. This is more than that.
So to backtrack a little bit, because I remember when you started the story last time, you said that you had gotten home late the night before, or at the very least, you had eaten something mm-hmm. when you got home.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, as you're not able to hold anything down, I'm assuming that anything that you had eaten the night before is out of you. Now, you're a guy who's in good shape, so your metabolism is pretty good, so you probably mm-hmm. burn things pretty quickly. But mm-hmm. I have to assume that at this point, as many times as you've had to vomit, it's probably not even food anymore. Now it's just fluids.
It's fluid. It's bile. It's funny that you mentioned the first time I let go, like the Tylenol didn't come out, like the water and didn't come out like that. It wasn't until like the third time that I could taste the Tylenol. And I was like, okay, so there's that. There's the pain relief. It's just going to hurt now
yeah.
because you can't keep anything down. The water you're sipping is coming right back up.
Right.
This garbage can that you have been throwing up in is getting full. you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So it was messed up.
And it's not like you were in a state of mind where you'd be like, oh, I'll just grab another trash can or whatever. You're just
mm-mm.
like,
no.
So you come to a point where you realize this is something serious.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a migraine. This isn't food poisoning. This isn't anything you've ever experienced
before. Right.
So you start to have that realization, which is scary enough, but then you're also experiencing the symptoms of the thing that you're realizing, which is, you know, you're starting to lose, or if you haven't already lost, the ability to control the right side of your mm-hmm. body. Mm-hmm. And you're right-handed, aren't you?
Yes.
So obviously this is affecting the left brain, but because you're right-handed, you're now having to do things with your left hand, and you're not ambidextrous,
mm-hmm.
I assume, but it's hard enough to do things with your non-dominant hand, but mm-hmm. also on top of the fact that your brain is fighting whatever it is that's happening to your body. So trying to do something normally, like we're sitting here right now, I'm right-handed, I'm not left-handed, I'm picking up this glass of water with my left hand, no
mm-hmm.
problem.
Mm-hmm.
But if I were having a stroke, and it was affecting the right side of my body. Now, even just picking up this glass of water with my left hand, which is easy to do, is not going to be easy to do. So once you've realized that, okay, something is seriously wrong, I'm going through this stuff, what was your thought process? What were the steps that you took in order to sort of, get to whatever next step that you needed to get to? Because there's really no plan for something like this.
Right.
They say that if you're going to have a stroke, have it in a hospital because, you're in a hospital. But at the very least, if you're going to have a stroke, hope that someone else is around.
Yeah.
Because it can be pretty debilitating. But you didn't have that luxury. Mm. So what happened next once you realized something's wrong?
Okay, so I go into a mind over matter thing because if my right side doesn't want to cooperate, I'm going to have to make it. So I just start overdoing things with my right to get it to go a quarter of the way that I want to go.
Sure.
With my arm and my leg. I think that me constantly thinking and me constantly doing things was more of a help than anything, because it kept my mind going and it kept me busy. As weird as that sounds.
Yeah, it's keeping your brain engaged.
Right. So I was, and it's amazing too how you go into this fight. I can't explain it, but my left hand became useful. You know, you don't think about it as being a useful thing. You think of it as being, I'm not right-handed. I'm not left-handed. I'm not this. But right. You become that.
It's like breathing.
Exactly. Exactly.
You don't think about it. You just do it.
Mm-hmm. Like when your lung collapses, your other lung starts to pick up the slack.
Right.
Same thing with the kidney or whatever. So I think I was able to move around as best as I could with my left. It wasn't great, but it was something. It's really hard to recall certain things. I remember everything, and it's just hard to enunciate, and it's hard to get everything out because everything happened so fast and slow at the same time. And we're talking about from 5:30 till I called Joey, probably about 1:00. So it's been hours.
And it probably feels like a lifetime.
It feels like a lifetime, but it still feels like it went by slow because, it feels like it went by fast because, like I said, I was trying to get my mind to be stronger than my body at the time.
Sure. From an adrenaline standpoint, obviously, again, and this will get brought up a lot in this conversation, you take care of your body.
Mm-hmm.
You exercise regularly, you eat right, that kind of thing. So from an adrenaline standpoint, is your heart, is your heart racing? Because, when we talked about this in the previous episode, I was surprised and also astounded by the fact that not only did you tell the story calmly, but in the story itself, you remained calm. You didn't panic. You didn't, fall off or anything like that. You remained laser focused. And maybe there's something to what you were saying before about, when something goes wrong with your body, the brain tells the other part of your body to compensate. So your right side is affected, and now your brain is telling the left side of your body, hey, let's go. You got to pick up the slack. So I'm assuming that while you're in your brain, you're maybe panicking or struggling to comprehend what's going on. Do you feel like your heart is pounding out of your chest? Do you feel like, you're struggling to breathe or anything like that? Because, I kind of call it the roller coaster effect. If you've never been on a roller coaster before, even if you love roller coasters,
mm-hmm.
you start to go up that steep climb, that slow, steep climb to the top. And right at the peak, just before you go down, you have that feeling of, oh, shit, oh, shit.
That's the scariest part of the roller coaster. Nobody wants to admit that. It's not the loop-de-loops of the corkscrews. It's the 2 seconds before you
the calm before the plunge, yeah.
I didn't panic. Like you said, the body goes into a survival mode,
sure.
right? So, it's. I knew that if I panicked, that everything was for naught. So I tried to stay calm. We're built to survive. That's just the human body. So, you just go into a survival mode. You don't think about, hey, I need to do this. I need to do that. Right. You just do it.
Well, and I don't remember if we talked about this in the last episode, but the human body, especially the brain, is a magnificent thing because sometimes when you're falling asleep and your heart rate goes down and your breathing recesses, the brain interprets this as the body dying. So mm-hmm. it sends a signal to wake it up. So you might have a leg twitch or mm-hmm. an arm twitch, and that's called the myoclonic jerk.
Right.
But the brain doesn't tell you. It just does it.
Yeah.
Because its job is to keep you alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so the human body, especially the brain, is a fascinatingly mm-hmm. complex and smart computer.
Yeah.
And so... you know, here you are trying to remain calm. Now, one of the things that you talked about, and I just want to sort of put this out there before we start talking about it, because this is difficult,
mm-hmm.
Is you came to a point, because let's talk about the fact that you sort of came to grips with the idea that this might be your end.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that thought process, which is a pretty forward-thinking thing to be able to do when in that situation, you willed yourself off of this couch that we are literally sitting right next to,
mm-hmm.
and you crawled with your arm
mm-hmm.
from this couch to your door,
mm-hmm.
and then you basically... I would assume with core strength, got yourself down the stairs,
mm-hmm.
got back on laid back down on your front, because you said when you got to the bottom of the stairs, you rested
mm-hmm.
because you needed to rest.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to the doors and you unlock the door.
Mm-hmm.
Then you rested again, and then you willed yourself back to the bottom of the stairs. You rested again, and then you made the magnificent climb back up the stairs. And you didn't get on your feet.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't step up the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
You literally, again, with core strength and whatever wherewithal you could muster, brought yourself back up the stairs and then back through the door and then from the door back to the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that time frame, you had already sort of come to grips with the idea that you may not make it,
mm-hmm.
or that you decided you're not going to make it, and that you don't want to be found by your wife in a state of, how some people are unfortunately found in this situation,
mm-hmm.
Where they void themselves or
mm-hmm.
They're in a pool of vomit or something mm-hmm. like that. And so you got back to the couch, and you get on your phone as best as you possibly can.
Because you got to remember, too, that I'm doing this with the trash can, and my eyes are closed.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because everything is spinning. Everything is, and spinning is one thing, because we've all been drunk, and we've done a thing where we put our leg on the floor because we get the spins. It wasn't spinning around. It was up and down. So I can't, it's just like a slot machine. I can't explain any better.
But, you know, when when, you know, when you're a kid, right, and the Nintendo or whatever stops working, you just turn it off and turn it back on. Or you blow into the cartridge or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what you do, and then it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that.
No.
You're basically, your brain turned into a 1985 NES system. And your brain's malfunctioning, and only half of it's working. But you don't have the luxury of shutting it off and turning it back on. You have to make it through whatever you're going through with what is working in your brain. And so on top of that, that means on top of having limited brain cognition, half of the dominant side of your body is not working. You're vomiting profusely. You have zero vision. One eye's doing one thing, the other eye's doing the other. You can't even see because you've got your eyes closed. You do not have the ability to walk straight or even clamber straight, even though you're not walking. Your brain is still trying to compensate for the things that are happening. So you have now made it back to the couch after going downstairs and locking the door. And to be clear, you did this because you decided that whoever was able to get here, they needed to be able to get in.
Yeah.
And the only way that they could do that is if the door was unlocked.
And unlocked and open.
Right. So you get to the couch, you grab your phone. Tell me about what happens once you grab your phone.
Okay. So I grab the phone. Actually, I can't find the phone, which is funny because I, at one point, I felt like I was going to pass out, so I wanted to put my legs above, my legs up to get blood down into my brain, into my head, but it hurt. It hurt really bad, so as soon as I was like, you're not going to pass out, you're fine. Get up, because this hurts. I had pushed the coffee table away to do that, so in... My phone was on the coffee table, so I was looking all over for the phone, like opening my eyes, looking, closing them, looking, closing them, looking, close. And it, so it took me a long time to find the phone. And finally, I found the phone on the coffee table about 3 feet away from me.
Which might as well be 60 feet.
Yeah. And I grabbed the phone and I started to I started to scroll. And mind you, this is probably around noon. I scrolled for about an hour, and then I would put the phone away because I would get dizzy. I would get sick as well. So finally, I scrolled to the phone from A to J, and I got to Joey's number, and then I was like, I'll call him. He's not that far from me, and like I said, he's a good dude. Like if he's not up at around this time, then you don't need to be. You know, this is it. You not that you've exhausted all your thing, because I've had people come up to me and saying you could have called me and
we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah, but at that time I'm like, if he doesn't answer, then you've exhausted your guys, your free guys, and it's just time to play. Like you said, game over. The game is up. Like you tried, you lived a good life. It's over. But he picked up. He I texted him first. He didn't text back, and then I called him a little while later, and he answered the phone. So
you know, and let's talk for a second about that, because in the previous conversation, you basically said, this is a one-shot deal. I have to pick my mark very carefully because it's exhausting enough just holding this phone.
Yeah.
And now you've got to look at this bright-ass screen, which is already hard enough because opening your eyes, you've got your eyes doing two different things. And so you got to make sure that whoever you can land on is going to be the person that gives you the best chance. And so for the people out there, and I will say this, I was one of the people who, after our previous conversation, I said, I feel bad that you didn't call me. Not, you should have called me, but like, I feel bad that I wasn't the person. And then I understood that it wasn't because you didn't want to call specific people. It's because you had to think about a lot of things like their geographical location mm-hmm. compared to yours,
mm-hmm.
the odds that they will answer the mm-hmm. phone and respond to a very, very dire situation.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the people out there who said, well, you could have called me, why didn't you call me? It's more complicated than that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything personal. It's not because he doesn't like you. It's not because he doesn't trust you. It's because this is a person who, in the throes of a very, very dire situation, has said, I got to make sure that whoever I decide to contact is going to be someone that can get here quickly,
mm-hmm.
but will also respond to my phone call.
Right.
And so you pick Joey.
Mm-hmm.
And like last time, I don't know who Joey is.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter who Joey is. But what does matter is that if not for Joey,
mm-hmm.
we wouldn't be having this conversation.
This is true.
And I kind of wish that we had gotten Joey here to have this be part of this conversation. Maybe we will down the road
mm-hmm.
if he's comfortable. But so you text Joey. He doesn't answer. You call Joey. He does answer. What happens when you call Joey?
I asked him, I said, good morning, man. No, I asked him I was like, what are you doing right now? And, he told me what he was doing. He was, hanging out with his girl and his girls. He was hanging out with his girls. And, I was like, cool, man. I didn't say it like that. I was like, do you have access to a vehicle? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, okay, cool. I was like, I need you to take me to the hospital. And he was like, okay, what's wrong? And I was like, I'll explain when you get here. But I need you to take me there now. And he was like, okay. And like I said before, he was fifth gear all the way over here. I don't know how he didn't get a ticket or whatever, but sure. He was here. He was here.
And you told him the door was unlocked.
Yes. I told him I specifically, I don't know. I told him that the door was unlocked. I was like, or did I? I think I told him because he wouldn't have known. He would have rang it. He didn't ring the doorbell. He just came on up. So I told him that. And like I said, I heard him running up the stairs and, he didn't say anything, but what's wrong, man? And I was like, I said, calm down. I need you to be calm because, like, I'm not one to panic because panic kills people. You know what I mean? Like, and panicky guys kill people. I've been around guys that have panicked and there's no need to, and then they get hurt. So I was like, look, man, I need you to be calm like I am. Can you do that? And he was like, yeah. And he said, and I was like, sit down. And he was like, what's wrong? And I told him, I was like, my head hurts. My right side doesn't work. He asked me if I was having a stroke. I was able to do everything that that said I didn't have a stroke from what we knew.
Sure.
As lay people. I told homie, I was like, hey, we're going to go to the hospital if that's cool. But before we go, like, we need to chill. Like, just sit here. And so he sat. Finally he was like, look, man, we've been sitting for a while. Let's go. Cause it's only going to get worse. And we left. He wanted to carry me down the stairs. But I was like, I wasn't going to put him through that. I'm like 170 something, and of dead weight.
Yeah.
And so like, there's no way you're carrying me down those stairs.
And
like,
they're narrow stairs.
They're narrow stairs.
For
also,
two people.
Also, he's not used to carrying dead weight like that.
Sure.
It's so we're not going to fall down them stairs together. We could do a lot together afterwards or. But we're not going to fall down them stairs.
When I'm better, we can fall down the stairs.
And so he went and got the car, and I crawled down the stairs again. I I pushed the bucket to the door. I didn't want him to see that, because he still would have tried to help. I know that guy. He still would try to help me down the stairs.
Sure.
And as much as I was sitting on the stairs and doing it myself, I feel like he would hurt himself or me. So just go wait in the car. I'll be down. You know what I'm saying? I'll be down there. And he was compliant. Like he got the car and waited. And I crawled down the stairs.
So we'll fast forward a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You get in the car.
Mm-hmm.
He takes you to the hospital.
Yep.
He's there until you get checked in,
mm-hmm.
and get taken back to see the attending ER physician.
Mm-hmm.
And after you're sort of settled in, you tell him, you know, hey, go ahead and take off.
Yeah. So we got there at probably 1:30. Joe didn't leave until about 6:30. So he was there for a long time.
Sure.
And I felt bad for him, because I'm sitting there in the wheelchair with my eyes closed, in the waiting room. I'm not saying anything to him. I can't. I really don't want to speak.
And you're exhausted.
Mm-hmm. He's not saying anything to me. He's probably. I don't know what's going through his mind, but like, I wanted him to go home right away.
Sure.
He wasn't gonna leave me there. Not like that. And so he didn't want to leave when I told him to leave at 6:30. He was just like, no. And I was like, go home, man. It's like I'm where I need to be. And he left.
So you're there for a few hours, and again, state of American medicine.
I know.
And I don't, that's a completely different conversation, mm-hmm. but that makes that that infuriates me, and it should infuriate everyone. But mm-hmm. at what point, because now, it's not a secret, you're a married man.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things that was constantly in your mind and thought process is, I'm not going to let my wife find me like this.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you've made it past the scary part, insofar as you accepted the fact that you might die.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were able to muster the will to get someone on the phone. You picked your shot correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Joey shows up. He gets you to the hospital. He sits with you while you're in the waiting room, and you're literally just sitting there. And I'm sure that mentally and physically, you're probably able to come down a little bit, because now you're not having to do all this work.
Mm-hmm.
Your brain can sort of try to reset the computer. Your body can rest from the grueling physical condition that you had to go through in that ordeal. At what point did calling your wife come into play, and how did that conversation go? Because if memory serves me correctly, she wasn't even in the same area code.
No. Okay. So it's about 6:30, and I tell Joe I was like, you could go. And he's like, all right, I'm about to go. Should I call her? And I was like, oh, yeah. Because I wasn't. I wanted to know what was wrong first, and then I would have got a hold of her.
Sure, because so, you don't want her to panic.
Exactly. I don't want her to panic from, because like I said, she left on Thursday. She wasn't going to come back till the following Saturday. Excuse me. I wanted to know what was wrong with me. I wanted to know, did I have a stroke? Am I settled in this hospital? Am I in my room? Then I'll make the call.
Sure.
But then he brought it up, and I was like, yeah, go ahead and call her. And he called her, and he let her know that, look, the doctor's saying this. So he puts on the phone with me, and I talk to her as calm as I can. Well, I talk to her pretty calm, and I want her to be calm. I'm like, you know, and she is. And I tell her, like, don't even come home. Stay where you're at. I will let you know what's going on when I know what's going on. I know it's going to be hard, but I'm doing good. I'm in the best place. She's trying not to cry. She's crying a little bit. And I'm just like, I tell her, I was like, look, I know it sounds stupid, but don't cry. You know, just be strong. And she said, okay. And then that was it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like we said, I love yous. And I hung up the phone and I gave it to Joe. And then I said, I'll talk to you soon. And he left. And then I was probably alone in that room for a little bit, which was fine because, like I said, I was so tired. I needed to rest. I needed to rest up and sort of like get my bearings about me too. Like I needed to realize I knew where I was as far as the hospital and the emergency and stuff, but I needed to get my bearings. Like this isn't the house anymore. This is the hospital. So you have to get in hospital mode.
Right.
I don't know if that doesn't make any sense, but it made sense to me. Like you need to get in hospital mode. You need to be ready with questions because they're going to come to you like you know.
Right.
What's going on. They're going to use certain words.
Well, they got to take an accurate family history mm-hmm. and they got to try to get that from you.
Yes.
And you're just struggling to stay awake
mm-hmm.
and to be a human being. And also, you know, you're pretty routine, and I don't mm-hmm. mean that in a negative way, mm-hmm. but you, again, you exercise regularly, mm-hmm. you eat the right stuff. You have a routine, and you're a lot like me in the sense that you don't like strange places.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're in your right mind, being in a place that you're not used to being in is hard enough. But now you're trying to combat that with the fact that you have limited cognition.
Yeah.
And you're just trying to figure out what the next thing is, because that's where your brain's still in survival mode.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here now. What's the next thing?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got to get to the bathroom. Okay. I got to the bathroom. What's the next thing?
Right.
Okay. I got to get downstairs. I got downstairs. What's the next thing? And so your brain is still in that survival mode. And so now you're in a hospital, which isn't a fun place to be in,
mm-hmm.
especially when you've sat in a waiting room for 6 hours,
mm-hmm.
for God's sake. And now you're, again, it's almost like you're outside of yourself seeing this situation, and you're telling yourself, okay, these doctors, these nurses, they're going to come in here and they're going to ask you a bunch of questions.
Mm-hmm.
I got to know the answers as best as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that's the thing with hospitals, especially if it's not a hospital that you normally go to. They have to take a family history
yeah.
because they have to see if this is genetic or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're in the hospital. They come into the room, and I'm not sure how much of that conversation you remember. And it's not even important, but at what, it is important, but at what point did a doctor tell you this is what happened to you?
It wasn't until, I talked to the ER. He asked me, the ER doctor, he asked me a certain amount of questions. Then I talked to the neuro, surgeon, and, he asked me the same questions. The nurse asked me the same questions. It wasn't until I had the CAT scan, and they had filled me up with the contrast.
Yeah.
That they were able to see, that a blood clot had went through my cerebellum. So then,
so was this in the same night or was it?
It was the same night.
Okay.
It was after, cause I went and got a CAT scan. Joe was still there. And then I went and got another one when he left. So it was around then when I was like, okay, this is it. Like you've had a stroke and they let me know right then.
So here it is the next night, and they basically told you, okay, we think you've had a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You're staying here.
Mm-hmm.
You got to run tests, I think at one point, and it may have been the next day or the day after that, you had a transesophageal echo.
Yeah, that was day two or three.
Okay. So you spent a total of how many days in the hospital?
Three.
3 days in the mm-hmm. hospital. They stabilize you.
Mm-hmm.
Did at any point did they tell you, you know, did they tell you that what your prognosis was in terms of like, because that's the thing, I guess that's the thing with a stroke is you never really know
mm-hmm.
what the damage is mm-hmm. until that person is there for a while and they can run whatever tests. At any point did they tell you, you know, what they thought your prognosis was going to be? And was there perhaps like a, they thought this is what it was going to be, but then it ended up not being that because of whatever reasons.
Mm. No, as far as that as prognosis is concerned, they didn't know because nobody, it's rare for somebody that's my age to have one like I had one.
A major stroke.
Right. And it's more rare for someone in my health range, I guess. You know what I'm saying? My health disposition is weird to them. So they were confused as to where and why it came. As far as them saying, hey, your right side will come back. Your speech won't be slurred. They didn't know. I wanted them to know because I wanted to know.
Of course.
But they were like, look, this is the deal. Like when people have a stroke, they're, it comes back gradually. It could be 3 weeks. It could be 3 years. Who knows? So, yeah. And I was like, okay, let's party. Let's get better. I just want to be fixed at this time. I don't care if you have to go in, go out. As far as the heart thing, the TEE scan,
yeah.
They later on figured out that, okay, since you have a hole in your heart, this is probably where how the stroke originated because
it shot a clot.
Right, right. People with holes in their hearts. Imagine a car with and you put oil in it, right? The engine is running good, but let's say that there's oil in the machine. There's not enough oil pumping.
Sure.
And that's what my blood was like. It just didn't have, I had enough blood, but my heart wasn't pumping it enough. So it made the blood thicker.
Sure.
Much like oil gets in an engine before the engine seizes. So my blood was like that and it formed a clot. Where it started, I don't know. Did it start in my legs? Did it start? I don't know. I didn't ask that question. All I know is it traveled up to my brain. And there's basically three you can get. There's to your brain, to your heart, and to your lungs. And you don't want to get it to your lungs because that is called a pulmonary embolism and people die.
Yeah, that's typically a fatal thing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it says that's as far as that's what I know as far as the doctor is concerned, what they told me.
Okay, so we've recapped
mm-hmm.
the events of March 3rd
mm-hmm.
and the subsequent hospital stay
mm-hmm.
and what the attending ER physician and neurologist basically told you. You've had a major stroke.
Mm-hmm.
Based on the transesophageal echo, we believe that the stroke was caused by the hole in your heart,
mm-hmm.
Throwing a clot
mm-hmm.
that traveled up to your cerebellum mm. and caused this stroke.
Right.
So now you have to think about rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
So here we are. We're still in March. Let's talk about first your wife coming home.
Okay.
and what that was like for both of you. And then let's talk about the rehabilitation process and what you've been going through with that. And because I know that in conversation with you, for you, it's like, how do I get better so I can get back to my routine?
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about, you've been, and this is the funny thing, is when we set up this conversation, the first conversation where you told me what happened in real time, you had just gotten out of the hospital.
Yeah.
Like you told me, I just got here 10 minutes before you walked in the
door. Yeah, I had got back from my brother's house. So I came March 6th, I got out of the hospital, which was a Wednesday. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday nights, I stayed at my brother's house. I got home Saturday, called you, let you know I was back, and you came over. So, yeah, I had just got home. I had just cleaned and blah, blah. You had
and that's
no idea.
The astounding thing to me is, like, in hindsight, you probably didn't even have time to take a piss or a shower or anything. Like, legitimately, 10 minutes after you got here, I walked in the door. I set up this podcast rig, and I'm thinking, I've got all this stuff I want to talk about, and then poof, all of that shit goes out the window because you're like, I got this story to tell you. And I'm thinking, oh, great, I love a good story. This will make a great episode. Wasn't expecting to happen. And of course, the reason you decided to tell the story this way is mostly because you didn't want to have to tell the story multiple times to different people and have to sort of trickle it down, because it's exhausting enough to go through your ordeal, but now you have to tell the story over and over and over again.
You have to relive it.
So Saturday comes around. I come here. We have this conversation. You know, I left, and I sat in my car, and I was struggling because I'm like, I can't believe, like, it just seems surreal. But between March 3rd, when you had the stroke, and March 6th when you got home, which was a Wednesday. No.
Well, I got home on the...
You got home on a Wednesday. You stayed with your brother. I came over on a Saturday, 10 minutes after you got here. Now, your wife is going to be coming home at some point.
That night.
So tell me about what's going through your mind, because now you're out of the hospital and you're like, you know, obviously I miss my wife. I wish she were here. And she's probably, you know, she's been mentally, she's home. She's not there. And so tell me about what happens when you guys finally are able to be reunited and that kind of thing. And obviously, you don't have to go into any detail you don't want to, but just from a standpoint of maybe how the conversation went and how, you know, how you felt going into that ordeal.
Okay. She gets home late. And it's weird because she got dropped off by her folks. And I go down there to meet her, and the first thing I do is, like, I grab her bag. I'm not supposed to be lifting anything, but that
it's routine.
It is, and that's out of my mind. So she's like, "Are you supposed to be lifting?" And I was like, "I wanted her to come home. You know what I'm saying? I wanted her to be home." So we got upstairs. We hugged for a little while. And I welcomed her home, you know what I'm saying? And she said, she got her things unpacked and stuff, and then we sat. And then I didn't really feel like telling her. I was tired by the also, and I just didn't feel like saying too much to her.
Maybe right after she got home.
Yeah, it was just too much. I believe the next day I probably told her what was going, you know, what happened and stuff. But
sure.
Like I said, I don't like being a burden. I don't like and it's not the man in me. I just don't want. Maybe it's the youngest in me. I don't know, but I don't want to be anybody's. I don't want to be her burden. So I didn't bring it up too much. If I played the episode of the podcast though, the beginning of it for her. It's like, this is kind of like what I went through.
That's crazy.
But she didn't.
I forgot that I put that episode out immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's hearing the story the same way that I heard the story.
Yeah, and I just, like I said, I didn't want her to know too much, but she needed to know a little bit. But I could have went into detail. You know what I'm saying?
Sure.
I didn't want to.
But also, based on what you said before, you refused to let her find you in that state. Mm-hmm. So to that degree, to that effect, you don't want to tell her about the state that you were in. But as her husband, you have an obligation to tell her what's going on with
you. Yeah.
So you have to balance between telling her what's going on and sort of painting a very broad picture about something that she's probably had the anxiety about, because, you know, you said, hey, stay put and don't, you know, I'm getting good medical treatment and everything like that. So she's probably freaking out this whole time, like, I can't wait to get home.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, it's walking that fine line, and you made the decision not to necessarily go into great detail, but then you said, hey, here's a podcast
episode. Yeah. And I also let her know later on, like, what the doctors, like, what I could rehash, what I could retell of what the doctor said, and as far as diagnosis and prognosis. And she was, and like I said, she got on that ball right away. Mm-hmm. Like, she was appointments, this, that, questions, whatever I said, she looked up, like, stuff, like, you know what I'm saying? Like a good woman supposed to, I shouldn't say supposed to, like a good woman does.
Sure.
You know what I'm saying? She was on it. So shout her out. She's a cool chick.
I think I'll keep her around. She's going places.
Yeah.
So your wife's gotten home. She's settled in. She's trying to get an understanding of what's going on, because like you, like me, she's like, how could this happen to you?
Right.
You take care of yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, it's not because you don't take care of yourself. It's because of something that you have no control over, which is that hole in your heart.
Right.
Which, by the way, I had a friend reach out to me who also has a hole in her heart.
Mm-hmm.
And she listened to the episode, and she was absolutely floored by how well you told the story. And also, just like, she's like, if he ever needs to have a conversation or wants to swap stories or that kind of thing, she's like, tell, like, I would love to. She's like, you know, tell him that I'm praying for him, and I hope everything's okay, and that he gets the treatment that he needs, because that shit's scary.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
And, you know, she's in her 20s.
Mm.
So, and she also takes care of herself.
But it's one of those things. 1 in 4 people have it. So 25% of the people of Earth have a hole in their heart.
And they just don't know.
Yeah. They don't know, because it doesn't affect them. They go to the grave without knowing. I just happen to have a stroke to let these people know that, this is why you had it.
Okay. So you've gotten out of the hospital. Wife's come home.
Mm-hmm.
You've had your conversations. What is now the path ahead? Because, again, you know, your wife gets home, and just out of routine, grab your bag upstairs, right?
Because
that's what you do.
Right.
Like a good man would do.
Right.
And so you tell her the story, however she finds out, however she absorbs the information. And now you've got to think about rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about, if you can,
okay,
the things that you, the doctors are now telling you have to do in terms of rehab, and then what other maybe procedures or things that you have to have done.
Okay. So my first appointment is with my primary, and my wife is she's with me. Like she's going to go to these appointments with me. And so we go in there. She's like, can I go in there with him? And they're like, yeah. So he comes in. He's like, so what happened, man?
Sorry. What the hell kind of question
is that? He said that. Those were his words. So what happened, man?
Like you hit yourself in the thumb with a hammer.
Mm-hmm. Now, 2 weeks before, I had the stroke. Like, I went into his office in February, and I told him, look, man, I'm dizzy. I'm feeling dizzy. I passed out at the gym 2 weeks ago. That's not me. Like, I know me. I know my body's not right. I went in to the store, and I was looking at a mattress in the store, and the quilt of the mattress had zigzags in it, and I got really dizzy. Like, so I explained that to him. I said, and then my heart wakes me up, and you know what I'm saying, when I'm sleeping in the middle of the night, I'll just wake up and my heart will be beating. This is not normal. Yeah. And he told me that it sounds like dehydration, or it sounds like vertigo, or just a lot of stuff that wasn't it. And so for him to say, what happened, man? And I'm giving you like, I'm giving you key words. Like, you should have sent me to the specialist then, but you can't live in the shitters. Right. So, I didn't get mad at him. He's just like, well, we're going to nip this thing in the butt. I can't speak right, by the way. We're going to nip this thing in the bud. So get ready, man. We're going to move, this appointment up. We're going to get you in a physical therapy. We're going to have you driving soon. We're going to have you doing all this. We're going to have you working out just like the video you showed me, man. We're going to have you doing all that. Like, everything is weed. Like, we're speaking French now. and it's not. It's like, I'm going to do this.
Right. You're not going to be the one who's rehabbing.
You're not going to be there.
Not like, bad for someone who was just dehydrated.
Right. So, he set me up with the appointments. I went to the to my first physical therapy. Shout out to the guy. I think his name was Paul. He was like, "All right, I'm gonna have you do this, this, and this." And I did it. He was like, "You're stronger than I thought you were. Like, you're very strong." To me, I was weaker than I thought I was. It was really weird.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because you know what your body's capable of. Mm-hmm. And right now your body's not at the level that it normally is to your standard,
right,
and to your routine.
Mm-hmm.
But he's thinking, this is a stroke victim.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that this person would be without the ability to do a lot of things. And maybe they thought that you were just going to be some 500-pound guy walking in there.
Mm-hmm.
This is a person that clearly takes care of themselves. So,
right.
You know, while he might be surprised that you're stronger than he thought you would be, he shouldn't be surprised if he knew your history.
True. Shout out to him, though. He was a nice guy. He's the one that told me, he was like, I don't see why you can't start doing, like, physical things again.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, do you do calisthenics? And I was like, yeah, that's my workout. And he was like, okay, instead of doing 20 pull-ups, try doing 5. No, he said, try doing 10. So I did 5, and I did 5 for a little while. And I would just do sets of 5. And I would flip-flop. Oh, then I would see a speech therapist because like I said, my right side was affected. And that also means my tongue, my lips, all that stuff was affected. So I speak like I'm drunk. To me, it sounds like I'm drunk. I slur things. I spit when I talk, certain things. And then on top of that, I quit drinking about 14 years ago. And I had a seizure in 2010 from alcohol withdrawal. And ever since then, I developed a seizure.
Impediment?
I developed a stutter from the seizure.
Oh, sure.
So I spent a lot of time masking that. When I would have a conversation with people, I'd stop because I could feel the stutter coming on. Now that stuff has been exacerbated. Yes. As far as the stutter is concerned, because I have another speech impediment on top of that.
Sure.
So a lot of the things I'll say don't come to mind. They'll come to mind, but my mouth won't say them. So it sounds like I'm talking funny as it is, and I can't get what I want to say out. If I get real excited, I can't get what I want to say out in the time that I've allotted myself.
Sure.
So I'll use different words. Even in this podcast, I've been doing it. But my speech therapist tells me to repeat. So your brain knows the words, how to say it. But it's not fast enough for me. I do that alone, but it's not fast enough for me when I'm speaking with you or speaking with anyone for that point. So it's really hard to explain, but I have a speech impediment now.
I think maybe the best way to explain it, if I may, mm-hmm. is that the part of your brain that develops the things that you're going to say is working the mm-hmm. way that it's supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
But in tandem with that part of the brain is the part of the brain that is supposed to process that information and help you get it out.
Right.
And that's the part that's affected. So mm-hmm. the processor is working,
mm-hmm.
but the hard drive is not doing the output.
There's a kink in the cord.
Sure. That's a great way to put it.
Or the neuron. So and instead of it has to go around in a loop-de-loop.
Right.
And a knot before it comes out. By the time it comes out, it could sound like gibberish.
Sure.
And it's funny because my wife is like, in the morning time, you sound great. I could tell when you're tired, exhausted, tired of speaking because I can barely hear you. And two, you start to slur more. It's weird. So like, it's the witching hour now. I don't know what time it is, but I could feel it.
Sure.
Like I could feel it coming on. I don't want it to.
It's 9:30.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't want it to.
PM, by the way, for those of you who are listening. and maybe that's a good point where I don't want to cut you off,
mm-hmm.
but also I don't want you to feel. Like, obviously, things are different now. And so your brain is working harder than it normally does
mm-hmm.
because it's trying to compensate because that's what the brain does.
Right.
Instead of having that straight, direct path from what you want to say to it being said, like you said, it has to now go, instead of taking a direct route, it's now got to take a scenic route or mm-hmm. take an exit and then, you know, a detour
mm-hmm.
before it gets there. So... I said this during the last conversation. I've said it, not on podcast, and I'll say it now. You are speaking remarkably well for someone who just a couple of months ago mm-hmm. had a debilitating stroke.
Right. Thank you.
And so, but, you know, don't feel bad that you're not able to articulate things in the way that you maybe once were. That's nothing to be feel bad about or ashamed of. And for the people who are listening, maybe that paints an accurate picture, and maybe pay attention as this conversation is going on and maybe mm-hmm. go back and listen to how the conversation started and his ability to speak and how clear it is to now, where maybe mm-hmm. it's a little bit more less pronounced. Maybe it's a little more difficult. It's a little bit more slow. It's not because intelligence. It's because the brain after work, I mean, you've, in your line of work, you do a lot of talking.
Mm-hmm.
And so now your brain has reached a point where it's like, okay, time to start slowly shutting down mm-hmm. and resting. Mm-hmm. So I want to sort of bookend this because you've done the rehab. You've been going to, you know, you slowly, obviously, the doctor says, hey, or the physical therapist says, hey, you do 20 this, mm-hmm. do 10. You're mm-hmm. doing five. You're doing five. You're doing five. Mm-hmm. You go back. You say, hey, I'm doing five with no problem. I'm doing 10 with no problem. When can I increase? When right. can I lift up more weights? That kind right. of thing. So you're following the regimen. Mm-hmm. They are they're impressed with your progress mm-hmm. because you're, again, sort of an anomaly. You're most people would not be in this position right after a stroke, but you have I think the fact that you take care of yourself so well maybe even saved your life.
Right.
Because anyone else probably would be bedridden at this point. Mm-hmm. And so now your doctor probably sends you to a cardiologist.
Right, right.
And the cardiologist says...
I go see the cardiologist, and he's like, yeah, we need to... this year, we need to close the hole in your heart. I'm like, fine, fix it. Whatever you have to do.
Right.
Just fix it. And he was like, okay, we'll schedule that probably in November. And I'm like, cool. Until then, what can I do as far as my workout regimen? And he says to me, go back to what you're doing. And I said, the full thing? And he was like, yeah. And I was like, say less, because I'm about to.
Finally.
So I started running. I started my calisthenic workout. Started doing everything. I was seeing my speech therapist, my occupational therapist, and my physical therapist. I let them know, look, I'm not trying to make a speedy recovery. I just want to win. Right. Okay, so whatever I want to win at that. They understood. So I only had to see them briefly because what they were giving me, I was already doing. As far as like working with my right hand, I was picking up coins. I was playing. I was trying to play the piano. I was already doing what they couldn't offer me anything that I wasn't doing. So they were like, "This is where we say goodbye," and I was like, "Bet." I just started working out again, and that felt great. And then I saw a heart specialist. Because my primary wanted to move up the surgery.
Sure.
From November to...
ASAP.
Whatever. And so I went and saw the heart specialist a bit at St. Luke's. And this is probably May 15th, maybe?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
May 12th, something like that. And he's like, yeah, you have a hole in your heart. We're going to close it. We're going to put some mesh in there. Are you allergic? Are you allergic to nickel? I'm like, no, I don't think so. I carried a nickel 380. Anyway. he's like, all right, bet. We'll schedule your appointment for May 23rd. And I was like,
it's May 22nd.
What are you talking about? Like, and he was like, yeah, May 23rd, we'll get you in. And I'm like, okay, I thought that I was going to have the summer, like, to kick it, like, whatever. And he was like, no, we're going to get this over with. So May 23rd, I went in there, and it was something.
So just to set some context here, because you and I had been talking, mm-hmm. right? And I had come over that week for a visit. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, lots of people reached out to me and they said that the last episode was really good and a follow-up. They'd love to hear a follow-up. And I said, hey, I'm working on it, but like, we got to do it on his time. He's, you know, he's going through a lot. This isn't a simple, you know, like before where I just show up and we just, you know, shoot the shit. You know, he's got things going on and his health is at stake. And so we talked about it. And then in that conversation, you told me, yeah, I'm having surgery next week.
Yeah.
And I'm like, next week? And you're like, yeah, just get it done. That's fine. This is going to be fine. I'm like, okay. Well, you know, you're going to have some recovery and some, you know, it's got to be, you know, got to take your time. And you're like, no, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Whenever.
Mm-hmm.
So literally, I think it was, I sent you a message. I don't know if it was, it maybe was the day of surgery or the day after, the morning after, seeing how you were doing. And when you finally responded, you're like, so when are we going to do this podcast? Like, you don't want to go home? And no, I'm good.
Yeah,
it's all good. But that's also like a medical marvel, right? Because that's how far we've come in medicine, is that, because you told me this is an 8-hour surgery.
And hang on a second.
Yeah.
This is where, see, I go into this thing where the doctor said, like, I heard 8 hours.
Sure.
The surgery ended up being an hour, right? Oh. What I heard was, be here at 8 o'clock. Be here at 8 o'clock. Maybe he said on the hour, but I was still, my brain is still focusing on the 23rd.
Sure.
Because it's major, you know what I'm saying? Like, that's 2 weeks.
Maybe he said, be here at 8 o'clock. We'll have you out of here at 4 o'clock, 8 hours. That's it.
Yeah. And I think that's because this is what it was. I was going to get the surgery done. I was going to be on bed rest till 8:15 that evening.
Yeah.
But it was supposed to be like an 8-hour thing. Because
it's a heart surgery.
You're right. And I was like, 8-hour surgery. And then I get there and then they're like, yeah, it should take about an hour and a half. An hour at the most. And I was like, I was prepared for 8 hours, man. This is even better than I thought.
It's like when you go to the mechanic and you're thinking, oh, it's going to take all day.
Mm-hmm.
And the mechanic's like, hey, man, we can shuttle you to wherever if you want to, but we'll have you in and out of here in an hour and 15 minutes. Like,
right.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I'll stick around for that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll watch basic cable in the waiting room while you get your shit together.
Sure. Yes.
I was just astounded because literally... the day after your surgery, you're talking like, hey, I'm good.
It was funny too, because when I went into surgery, like they gave you anesthesia, right?
Yeah. But
they don't put you all the way under. Now, most people can't remember what goes on.
Sure.
I remember everything. I remember looking at the monitor that they were looking at, like, you know what I'm saying? I remember the nurses when they're putting a thing on me.
Wait, they didn't put you completely under for this surgery?
No. Mm-mm. And I asked them too when I got out, I was like, was I supposed to be all the way under? Was I supposed to be under for that? And they were like, well, we don't put you all the way under. So most people don't remember what was going on. I remember the two doctors talking, you know what I'm saying? I'm like looking at them and I'm looking at the monitor and then I'm looking at the nurses running, like going back and forth. I remember a lot of it. And then I remember the ride back. I remember.
Oh, Christ on a bike, man. I could, like, when you said that they gave you anesthesia, I thought maybe they gave you some before they wheeled you into the OR and gave you the final, like, dose. Because I've never had surgery, and God forbid I ever have to have surgery, but, like, the anxiety that I feel about it is great because, like, you go in there and you know, they're putting you to sleep, basically.
Yeah.
And then they cut you open.
Mm-hmm. This was the cool part about that. They didn't have to crack my chest or anything. They went up in the vein, through veins, through my groin.
Sure.
Through the groin area.
Yeah.
Which is fascinating because, like, minimal scars, like, there aren't any. And that's cool that they don't have to crack your chest open and
you don't have move a zipper. Your
chest plate. And yeah, because I know a few people that have had surgeries when they were, like, in the 80s, when they were born, or a few months after they were born, and they still have the scar.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how they, it's amazing.
Like, yeah, because they got to crack the chest. They got to, you know, they got to open the rib cage, and they have to get in there.
Yeah.
But then also, I have to believe that because you're already, I don't want to say impatient, but excited about getting back to your routine. Now that you know, hey, they're not cracking my chest open. Mm-hmm. They're going up through the groin. It's minimally invasive. Mm-hmm. I can get back to my routine pretty quickly.
Right.
And I think that was part of the reason I was so surprised, because here I am thinking, like everyone else, that they're going to have to get into your chest for this surgery to close this hole in your heart. And you're like, nope, they're going through the groin.
Yep.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's fine. Oh, you don't need to recover? No, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And just put a Band-Aid on it. You know, maybe some rope, some tussin.
Some tussin, man. sprinkle some cinnamon crack on you and shit. It was also exciting, too, that one stitch on each, because they, like I said, they went in to both legs.
Sure.
One stitch. However, they did take one out because they kept, they used the term oozing. Basically, it means bleeding.
Yeah.
So they came in and they would check, and finally they called a doctor, and they were like, that wound keeps oozing. And so he's looking at it, and he's taking like a little gauze, and he's tapping it, and he's like, yeah, it is oozing. And then my wife is like, yeah, it's oozing bright red. And like, if you know veins are dark. Arteries, however, are bright red. So he was like, "Well, I'm gonna take this stitch out. I'm gonna put this thing on it that it basically puts pressure on the wound. We're gonna put this on there for a couple of hours. So we're gonna extend your bed rest from 8:15 for a few more hours."
Sure.
So they kept checking it. Every now and then, like the nurse, she circled it with the pen. She was like, okay, like if it goes past this means you're still oozing.
Mm-hmm.
At 2:30, she was like, you don't seem to be oozing anymore. And it was, I was like, okay. So she was like, let's go for a walk. And then you could go to the bathroom.
Sure.
I'm like, all right, cool. We go for a walk. I'm able to walk well. And then I go to the bathroom, and she says, if anything happens, pull on this red string.
Mm-hmm.
So I go, I relieve myself. And as I'm relieving myself, I feel like water running down my leg. And I reach down, and it's not water. It's blood. And it's long story short, they I think they nicked an artery.
Ooh, okay.
And so I'm bleeding. And so I don't pull the red string. I wash my hands, and I open the door, and I'm like, I'm bleeding. And she was like, okay, let me go get the bed. Let me go. So she gets the bed, and another nurse comes in. Because I get in the bed, they take me to my room. And another nurse comes in, and she puts pressure on my groin area. And she probably has it there for, I don't know, about 10 minutes. She's sure. pressing. And the whole time I'm trying to like, I'm not the whole time, about 8 minutes into it, I need to lift my leg up because I'm starting to feel funny.
Yeah.
But I don't want to interrupt her. So finally she gets done. She was like, it's not bleeding. I was like, all right, good. Cause I think I'm about to pass out. So, I need to put my legs up. And she was like, oh my God. So she ends up putting my bed up. So my legs are over my head, and then the blood rushes to my head again. She didn't want me to bleed anymore. She didn't realize how hard she was pushing, and it was making me, it was like a sleeper hold.
Yeah.
And she made me, she almost made me pass out. It was funny. But yeah. She had me in a crossbody.
So Nurse Chuck Liddell was there.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Brock Lesnar came in and finished you off.
Yeah.
So I got two questions left.
Okay.
Question number one, how are you feeling now? Now that we've obviously you've gone through this ordeal, and to be clear, this you've had the surgery and everything, and you made a point before, which is, you know, the stroke gradually comes back, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So this will never be over.
No.
But now, call it 3 months mm-hmm. after this, or maybe call it 4 months because you started to experience these symptoms in February. Mm-hmm. How do you feel right now, now that you've gone through this and now you've had the surgery and you've recovered a little bit?
I feel the same. I feel, after I had the stroke, I feel the same. I haven't really got a chance to, because it's going to take like 6 months for the flesh to grow over the mesh, to close the hole completely. But I feel all right. I feel good. I don't feel like I feel good. I look at it this way. I'm a new version of me. I'll never be that guy again.
Sure.
I'll never be 100% that guy. So I need to be 100% this new guy. Mm-hmm. So I'm working on that. So right now I'm probably about at 72% of this new guy. And I'll figure him out.
Okay. And I think it's important to note that for the people out there listening, and maybe these are some of the same people who said, you know, you should have called me, blah, blah, blah. Patience is the name of the game, right? Mm-hmm. Because you have to, this all has to happen at your pace.
Mm-hmm.
What your body allows, what your brain allows, what your recovery allows.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, it's a scary thing to think about your mortality, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about that in the last conversation, which is you don't think about mortality until you do,
mm-hmm.
and then you do, and then it's scary.
Yeah.
And so now being removed from the situation, not removed, but now that you are certainly on the other side of the situation, there has to be a degree of maybe planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if it happens again, you have to have a contingency in place.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, obviously don't want you to have to go through the ordeal where you're like, who do I call? What do I do? The last question I want to ask you, and maybe there's not a great answer to this, or maybe this is a question that could be more comprehensive later, mm-hmm. is what do you have to or want to say to the people out there who may be any advice? I know you're not a advice person because you're not necessarily advice, but you're not a person who tells people how to live their lives, and neither am I. But maybe through this ordeal and now this new version of you, as you said, you've come to grips with some things, and maybe some of those things are things that would be helpful for other people out there to know. So what would you say to those people listening that might be beneficial for them to know? Or maybe mm-hmm. you later down the road, you re-listen to this episode and you hear this advice or this nugget of wisdom and you think, yeah, I'm glad that I said that, or I'm glad that I mm-hmm. went through with that. So go ahead. I'll give you the last word.
I put it like this. We're put on this globe or marble or whatever you want to call it. as I wanted to be poetic, but the only thing that comes to mind is that we're born to die, right? We're dying slow. How do you want to die? Like, do you want to die with regret? Do you want to die having known something? Do you want to die having done something?
Sure.
Because it's inevitable. We're born to die. So try to have some fun. You know what I'm saying? Like love as much, hate as much, whatever. But don't be that guy or that girl or the whatever. Don't be the person that just sits there and waits to die. Do something. Have fun with it.
Don't be that person that just sits there and waits to die.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as poetic as you can get. That's certainly better than saying something like YOLO or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do something with your life.
Yep.
Whatever that means to you. Well, as always, it's a pleasure to have you on this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure to call you a friend. What,
26
years
now? Yeah.
And in all of this, I'm just glad that you're okay. We're all glad that you're okay. And that's the important thing.
Thank you.
Whatever it means for you to recover, that's what it means. And if there's anything I can do to help, certainly please let me know. But also for those of you out there, you know, be patient and be understanding. My guest, Chavez, thank you for joining me. Always a pleasure. Good night, and we'll talk to you guys next time.